Hey, yo, what is a cypher?
You know, at like 2 years old, they're making beats.
The knowledge of the cypher is to enlighten you.
Where you think the cypher come from?
The gods.
Because you tried to jump the cypher and it goes this way.
Welcome to The Cypher, a weekly podcast where we bring you conversations with the most interesting figures in hip-hop and culture. I'm your host, Sean Sotaro. This week, we talk to Quelle Chris. Quelle is a rapper and producer who originally hails from Detroit. Though, as you'll hear, he's also passed through St. Louis, Los Angeles, Chicago, Brooklyn, and more. He got his start with Detroit's Wasted Youth crew, teaming up with artists like Denmark Vesey, Big Tone, and even Danny Brown, the last of whom used two of Quelle's beats on his breakthrough album, Triple X. Quelle's music runs the gamut from aggressive beats to experimental synth pop, and his subject matter goes from raunchy humor to intense conversations with God. His most recent solo album, last year's Innocent Country, is his most powerful and wide-ranging work yet. We met up with Quelle at Crosstown Studios in Harlem. If you enjoy The Cypher, make sure you subscribe to it on your podcast app of choice. That way, you'll get every episode as soon as it comes out. You'll also be able to check out our archives. If you enjoy this show, for example, you should check out our interview with another of Detroit's favorite sons, Denon Porter, on episode 119. Speaking of our archive, if you want us to keep adding to it by making new episodes, visit patreon.com/thecyphershow and become a patron. Even a couple bucks a month will go a long way. You can find more information about this episode, including a list of the songs we play, at thecyphershow.com. While you're there, make sure to sign up for our monthly newsletter to keep track of everything that's going on with us. And now, here's a man who's not too tough to admit he loves arts and crafts, Quelle Chris.
I like playing around with stuff. I just like music. I like the voice as like an instrument.
You've talked about that before. I think the idea of like seeing the voice, not just as something that speaks, but as as an instrument as far as like texture and stuff like that and sound also.
I mean, it's so important in hip hop. I mean, equally important is production. A lot of people don't give the producers enough credit because I mean, what's a good rap song with a crappy beat? But I mean, you know, the voice is something, man. It's like, you know, because like, and I mean, maybe we have talked about this prior or something like that, but you know, I mean, you're not, there's only one person that can play the Guru, or there's only like one person that can play the Buster, or there's only one person that can play the ODB. And then when, and then someone else can like come in and they'll like, you know, they'll might sound like this person or that person, but then, you know, it's like they sound like this person or that person, but like, especially in hip hop, like that original voice is just very, very important.
Yeah, you can definitely have a lot of people who get over mostly on their voices, kind of rather than
rather than
what they're saying.
I mean, you know, I have a little bit of a speech impediment myself, but I mean, I play to it, and I, you know, I think it makes for very interesting raps. You know,
you like spend a lot of time thinking about placement. Right, phrasing and like where your words fall on the beat and stuff like that.
Yeah. Cold state, the smell, Colgate, the style, smooth oil of Olay, roll A, lots of motor. Guess it's the culture, death at the altar. Soon as you married into it, rock of Gibraltar, so stock up your armor.
Latency, you know, I mean, different things like that. I don't, you know. Patterns. Pattern is so key to me too. I think it's key to like majority of my songs. I talked to, you know, Jean Grey, you know, about this. She likes, you know, a lot of constantly and quick switching patterns, et cetera.
I'll say.
And, you know, sometimes, and, you know, I talk about the magic and minimals sometimes, you know, so there's a lot of times when I'll do a song. And I mean, if you were to count all the words in the verse, it might only be like five words, but I make it make those five words really work for 16 bars. You know what I mean? Like some it's about, you know, for me, a lot of times it's just about getting to the point, but in the most simple and interesting way at the same time.
Yeah. What's some stuff as far as like phrasing and placing stuff in the beat and whatever that you try not to do?
Interestingly enough, I think I try to do everything. I'm always looking for what I haven't done. So I think, if anything, what I try not to do is something that I already did. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So that's why sometimes it'll take me, you know, 3 years, 4 years to finish another album sometimes, even though it seems like I put out so much stuff and I don't even know how that works out, actually. I don't get how I have right. so many projects. But it's because, like, I'll start writing a song and then kind of sit on it, you know, nod out to it a little bit, and I'll be like, dang, you know, I kind of hit that pattern like 6 albums ago. I'm not going to do that again. So I guess the only thing I try not to do is not bore myself, you know, because I make a lot of the music mostly just, you know, I know this is kind of a cliche thing to say in hip hop, but I make a lot of the music just because I need something to listen to. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I don't really listen to a lot of projects. It's like weird, like, you know, like all the, like the Danny Brown projects.
I was born one day before St. Pat. I guess a nigga missed luck just like that. Henry Ford, not even 1 mile from Motown, explains all the soul that you hear in my sound.
I mean, a lot of these projects, you know, it's weird to say this, but I don't really listen to a lot of, like, even projects that I'm involved in. It's like the process of making it is me enjoying it. And then once I've made it, I just let it be out there for other people to enjoy. A lot of times I don't even go back and listen to it.
You said something one time about how, like, good music kind of wasn't enough. You're like, good music is like bad music to me.
Yeah.
Like, it's easy for me to make good music. Mm-hmm. And so you kind of don't care about it. Don't bother with it. Like,
yeah.
I think most people would be pretty happy if they could make good music most of the time. Like, what are you looking for beyond something being good?
I think, you know, nowadays everything is so easily accessible, and especially as, you know, new generations pop out, you know, sprout up. It's like hip hop is just kind of a second language. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
It's not like something where, you know, even when I was younger and, you know, the hip hop generation, you know, one before me, where it was like you were learning things and, you know, so many like new, fresh ways to approach things. Cause I mean, it was a baby. I mean, essentially at this point, it's still just kind of like a young adult, but, you know, it was a baby. So, you know, everything was still new. There was all these new ways to approach things. But nowadays it's like, you know, they pop out knowing how to use Ableton and how to use Fruity Loops, you know, at like 2 years old, they're making beats. And you know what I mean? So nowadays it's like, okay, all right. So you can write the alphabet, like, you know how to write A through Z, you know, now how can you take it to the next level? Because so that's what I mean by like, good is like bad. Now everybody can be like, all right. And you know, there's so much to emulate. So there's that too. So it's like, you know, okay, I mean, that's just sounds like a rap song. You know what I mean? What makes it special? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. And I think one of the things with you is like, you play around with song structure a lot,
mm-hmm.
right? There's that song on Blue Monday. It's one of the first songs, the one with a heavy guitar. Blue Monday's the title track.
Oh, Blue Monday.
It's like super, super slow.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like a 3-bar phrase, right?
Yeah.
Super unusual.
We say hey to the ladies, woof woof to the bitches,
yes.
Out of our assholes, backpedaling fast, don't, listen, don't fuck, this is not a movie, note the back.
And just in general, as far as song structure, it's, you know, you're not doing like 3 16 bars verses with an 8-bar
mm-hmm.
hook in between. Like, you do that sometimes, but playing around with that a lot more.
Yeah.
So when you're writing a song, do you think about structure? Like, how do those like different choices come about?
And it's different. It varies from time to time, but I'd say a lot of like my favorite songs, if I could like give a visual of how I come about them, it's like, I'm like sitting in a small room with a bunny rabbit, and like the bunny rabbit's like rolling around and doing cute stuff. And then when it does that real cute thing and I go kind of giggle, then I'm like, okay, that's it. That's what I'm always looking for, that moment that makes me kind of chuckle, like, whoa, I haven't heard anything like that before. That's silly. I'm going to do it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And sometimes it'll be like, man, like that's going to be whack. And then I know that it's good too, because if it sounds weird to me, then I'm sure it'll sound weird to other people. And as a result, it'll sound like refreshing. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And I prefer, you know, I've heard people say things like, oh man, your music is challenging and stuff. And it's not challenging. But then again, I take that as a really good compliment, because that means that you're having to adjust your brain, the way that you normally listen to rap songs, to go like, why isn't the chorus there? Why is the chorus just one word? And then he goes into like a, you know, 4-bar verse, and then the chorus is different the next time, but it's 3 words. And then he goes into a, you know, 16-bar verse, a regular 16. Then he goes back to the 1-word chorus. And, you know, I mean, like, I like when it just kind of those little moments where I like chuckle and go, yeah, I've never heard that before. That's so silly. That's so stupid. Let's do that.
Yeah.
Look at that. That's so cute.
It's funny. You seem to have this weird balance where, like you said, you'll let songs marinate and you'll like spend a lot of time and try to do different stuff. But at the same time, I know you make a lot of things in the studio. Like, you don't go into the studio with a lot of like pre-existing ideas.
Mm-mm, no, yeah. I think like portions of Blue Monday I did in the studio. Portions of Ghost at the Finish Line and portions of Shotgun, right?
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of stuff I'll do just, like, let's take The Sun, for instance.
Act like you don't know who got the coldest flow. Ladies hold the dough, provide handkerchiefs to blow the nose. Learn how.
I mean, I recorded a lot of The Sun laying in bed. And then the last song, I think I recorded laying on the homie John Kim's couch. And then one song I did in the closet, like sitting down in the closet in the dark. And it's, you know, so, you know, just kind of also playing around with just the environments, you know what I mean? Niggas as Men kind of came about just from, you know, me and Cav.
Cav is cavalier, Coley's frequent collaborator.
I was staying at Cav's place for a little while, and, you know, it's one of those, you know, regular Brooklyn apartments. So, you know, there's a little small room that's connected to his room, you know, it's connected to the hallway. And it was just this interesting energy of like, okay, I would just kind of like, I would set up the little snowball mic, you know, the ones that people use for like, you know, Skypes and stuff. And I would set that up. And I would be laying on the futon, and I might like start recording something, and then he'd hear it in the other room and be like, dang, that's crazy. I was feeling the same way. And then he'll start writing something, or like I would turn on a beat and we would both just start writing. And then I'd be like, what you got? And he'd rap, and I'd be like, yo, that's crazy. That's exactly what I was just writing. You know what I mean? But like, I think that's how the music also sounds, you know, very, very, original a lot of times, and organic, because it's not made in like a sterile, you know, most musicians, it's this process where like I record here, you know, they have a process. I don't like having a process, you know. Mm-hmm. What I mean, I like the challenge of having to just figure out how it's gonna happen and then just let it happen from there.
One of the things that's interesting about your process, I don't feel like you've said that there's not much of a division in your head between producing and rapping. You don't necessarily see them as like two separate Mm-mm. things.
Yeah, they all play to each other. If you know, riding the beat, you know. So, I mean, what's the magic behind the pattern that you're rapping if the like Dragon Ball Mugen thing or whatever that is, like, you know, if they don't basically become one, you know what Mm-hmm. I mean? That's always like that. But I mean, I guess that could be one of my weaknesses, though, because I really don't like rapping a cappella. Like, you know what I mean?
You're not gonna be doing any battle leagues,
dog. I fucking hate cyphers so much, man. Like, leave me the fuck alone. I do not want a cypher. But you know, because I like songs. You know what I mean? I think that's the thing. I'm not just like just rapping. You know what I mean? I like songs.
Yeah, and you know, as far as production, you know, we've had a lot of producers on here and talked a lot about producer ethics, yeah, right? The kind of unwritten rules among producers. You've been very open about using all kinds of sample sources, including like YouTube and things like that,
mm-hmm,
which yeah, is something, which is a very different ethic than producers in the 80s and 90s who had a whole bunch of different rules about you can only sample from
yeah,
original pressings, mm-hmm, you can only sample in vinyl, no compilations, all that yeah, stuff. Were those ever rules you knew about or cared about or adhered to at any point?
Yeah, no, I mean, I would say, like, outside of just, you know, just naturally, you know, coming into hip-hop because my brother was, and, you know, all the people around me and Tone and, you know, Big Tone Detroit and, you know, hearing them making tapes and, you know, they're getting the Slum Village tapes from Bar 10 and hearing those and, you know, just being naturally just... you know, just wanting to start getting involved in it myself as I, you know, started to get a little more into like the teenage years. Outside of that though, it's weird. I kind of was like formally, like not formally trained, but like, you know, I would say like the equivalent to like a Obi-Wan and, you know, Luke type deal with hip hop where, you know, I mean, there's, you know, Swing Low the Bro, you know, from Detroit, you know, in my mind, legendary with the breaks and stuff. So, you know, I would go over to his crib, you know, and he would, you know, he would teach me about how to tell the difference between an original pressing. Like, if you see like this, that's how you know it's an original pressing. Now, see, this is a break. And, you know, like he would, so I was taught all those things. And I've been making beats, I mean, since, I mean, at least probably like, I don't know, like maybe like 11 or 12 or something like that, or, you know, something like that. So, you know, I've gone through all the different processes. I think that plays back to the same thing where, you know, after you've done, you know, I don't like doing the same thing over and over. So, you know, I've done vinyl, you know what I mean? And had my dad's record collection and learned about breaks and done, you know, your regular, you know, like you said, producer ethics type production and, you know, hardware and switched over to software and synths and, you know what I mean? Like after you start playing with everything else or after you've played with, you know, what's considered the standard. And if you want, like I said, if you want to keep pushing the music, you get to the point where you're like, okay, now I got to start sampling PBS specials, you know, putting the mic next to the TV, getting some PBS specials. And then it's like, oh, shoot, like, you know, VHSs and, you know, oh, crap. Okay, now I could get samples off of DVDs. And then it was like, oh, the internet. So now I can sample whatever I want, you know. And then, you know, then you have the whole world with field recordings and you can make all types of stuff just out of just regular noises and here and there. So, yeah. I mean, I definitely learned and went through the whole process of kind of, you know, reluctantly call it like uppity producer type, you know what I mean? You know, I kind of went through that and I went through my phases where I was like, no, nah, man, that's whack if you're doing this or no, nah, that's whack if you're doing that. But then, you know, you grow. And, you know, you could either grow into a stubborn old man or you could, you know, grow into like a, you know, like the weird old guy with like, you know, six arms and his brain is super big and stuff. You know, that's what I want to grow into.
So it sounds like something definitely to aspire to. You mentioned, you know, Batan and Slum Village there a minute ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that Fantastic Volume 1 was like your shit for a long time, right? Which wasn't even released officially till about 10 years ago.
Yeah.
Slum Village, a group originally made up of Batan, J Dilla, and T3, recorded their first album, Fantastic Volume 1, in 1996 and 97, with all production handled by Dilla. Cassettes were sold at concerts and in local stores. Many of the songs were redone for the group's follow-up, Fantastic Volume 2, and Volume 1 did not receive an official release until 2005. Dilla passed away in 2006, and Batan passed as well in 2009.
So where did you first come across the bootleg? Is it just something everyone had?
I got it from my brother. And I think if my memory serves me correct, he got it from Batan. Or he got it at least, you know, via, you know, our uncles and just our you know, family is all kind of tied in with that hip hop shop era.
The Hip Hop Shop was a clothing store in Detroit that was opened in 1993 by designer Maurice Malone. It quickly became known for hosting Saturday open mics, which were hosted by the rapper Proof of D12 fame. These open mics can be seen in fictionalized form in the movie 8 Mile.
So, no, I was in living in St. Louis, and he brought it back from Detroit. He played it. I don't know, man. That thing blew my mind, man. It was something about the simplicity of it, you know. But with Dillis production, the intricacy of the simplicity of that.
Okay, that's my man T. Three. I'm the one to be. Play like them niggas that you used to play for money and no type of acting. Funky. With me, and best believe that you won't do it. I'm influenced to life.
But I think it was just kind of one of those things that I think if you were around that hip hop shop time, you know, you got all that type of music, you know.
Yeah.
And we burned that tape out.
I'm sure. Yeah. And it's funny because you can't, you know, that version of it, you can't find anywhere, right? Even the one they put out in 2005, like bonus cuts and, you know.
Yeah, I haven't even heard that one. Only version I know of it is that Maxell tape.
No, I've definitely heard you say like, oh, I used to pass the time by playing it in my head kind of beginning to end.
Yeah, I can still almost kind of do it.
So speaking of Detroit, I know you haven't I lived sort of full time in Detroit for quite a while, but people still, I think, associate you with that city and that scene because, you know, that's kind of where a lot of people first heard of you, you know, producing for some of the artists there and working with some of the artists there. Mm-hmm. Is that ever like, how do you feel about that, about, you know, still being associated so strongly with a city you haven't really lived for a while?
I mean, I love Detroit. I guess it's kind of interesting that happens, but, you know, being associated with a city outside of what you personally represent, because, you know, all my family is from Detroit, you know, up until like now, pretty much most of them have all always lived in Detroit, but, you know, have slowly started moving out of the city, et cetera, et cetera. So, I mean, it's not weird for me to be associated with Detroit, even though I have moved around a lot, because I mean it's what I always associate with home anyway. But the whole, you know, being associated with a city thing, it's very fickle. So it really doesn't, you know. I know I'm gonna probably catch a lot of flack from cats from, you know, fam and all that from Detroit for this, but you know, when I lived in Oakland, I would put out some music, and then people would say, you know, Oakland rapper Quelle. And then when I lived in LA, I would put out some music and people would say LA rapper Quelle. And you know, there's still people I talk to that are like, man, you ain't from Detroit, you from St. Louis, because I lived in St. Louis for so long. And you know, when Slutbag Edition and all that was out, you know, people would be like, you know, Chicago rapper Quelle. So you know what I mean, like it's for me, it really, I mean, home is something that matters personally, but as far as like the whole like what city do you rep hip hop part of it, I really don't care. You know what I mean? And I know that sounds terrible, but I mean, the music is what matters to me. I think a lot of times people, you know, people will ask that when they first hear something. Sometimes they'll be like, oh, where's this dude from? Like, why? Just listen to the music, man. You know what I mean? I don't want people to like my music just because I'm from Detroit. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Yeah,
I don't want people to, you know, like this album because, you know, they think I'm part of the L.A. scene, or they, you know what I mean? Like, just like the music, man. So I try to, you know, I know that it's important, but it's not what I think is that important, just because I feel like it gets in the way of the way people view things, as do a lot of shit now as far as, you know, the music industry is concerned.
Yeah. And I know growing up in the Midwest, you had exposure to a lot of regional hip hop that, you know, people on the coast maybe missed, including Cash Money before their Universal deal kind of broke them open in 98. I know you're a big fan of a lot of that stuff. How'd you, because, you know, we've had Lil Slim on the show.
Uh-huh.
And as far as I know, that stuff was basically only, you know, cities that people could drive to from New Orleans even got it. Like, how'd you come across it?
St. Louis, you know, St. Louis is like, it's like the fake South, you know what I mean? Like, it's the Midwest, but it's, I mean, It is, you know, they you'll talk to somebody from St. Louis and they'll be like, we don't talk like that, but it's real hurler, word, bird.
I like the way you do that right there, right there. Switch your hips when you walk and let down your hair, down your hair.
It's very South, you know what I mean? And so when we moved to Detroit, or not to Detroit, when we moved to St. Louis, one, everybody would ask me if I knew Martin. Because, you know, Martin was set in Detroit. Like, looking back, it's a funny question, but it's a real, like, sincere kid question. Like, do you know Martin? You know what I mean? You're from Detroit. You know what I mean? But also, you know, I was kind of considered like a, you know, like my best friend from St. Louis, the guy I started rapping with. It wasn't until like maybe like the end of high school, and we knew each other since, you know, sixth grade. And it wasn't until like the end of high school that he, like the last year of high school, maybe like the maybe junior year or something like that. And he just started to kind of really like hip hop. Like, you know what I mean? He just started to like be like, okay, I get why you like this Dilla stuff. And you know what I mean?
Hip hop meaning not South.
Yeah, not, I'm sorry. That type of hip hop. So, you know, they're really hard. They were really into that. I mean, all the, you know, UNLV.
Oh, who got the fire? It's what a chump said. I got the Glock by my side and Tech 9 is still spring. Get into it with a nigga, gotta tow my gun. Get into it with a nigga, gotta tow my gun.
I mean, just anything of that nature. A 666, you know, the early Juicy J stuff and all that.
Break them hoes, rag, clean, smoke your dope. Give me something, bitch. I'm talking about dollar cents. Give me something, bitch.
You know.
Are there any early...
Even just like, you know, the regular, like, you know, bigger stuff, you know, but...
Are there any Quelle Bounce songs floating around?
Not probably floating around anymore, but yes, they did exist. I was torn because you're young. Everybody else around you is making that. So, you know, I would make some more expected from what you know me to make now type hip hop. But no, yeah, I definitely, like, if y'all niggas can't spell, it's T-O-P, top notch motherfucker, because it was top notch entertainment. Motherfucker, Tubi D-I. Yeah, I used to do all that.
Just so in case people couldn't spell top, you were there to help them out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's T-O-P, top notch motherfucker, Tula D-I-E.
Yeah, I noticed even now in a lot of your recent stuff, like Uncle Luke and 2 Live Crew will kind of come through in samples or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Don't stop. Don't stop.
I bet you never made a scrape before.
Oh, man. Yeah. I mean, I still personally put Juicy J up there as one of my favorite producers. You know what I mean? I don't think a lot of people do that. But he, like, that old stuff, man, that stuff was hard. That's some ill production, man.
Yeah. And it's funny now that, you know, mainstream hip hop, for lack of a better term, is only now catching up to what Juicy right. J was doing yeah. in like 1995 or whatever.
Exactly. Like some of what was that one that ASAP Ferg song, that Shabba Ranks?
Mm-hmm.
That sounded exactly like Juicy J Hoes in This House 96 or 97. That was like the exact same song.
Right.
You know what I mean? I'm like, what year did that Shabba Ranks? It had to be like about like 3 years ago.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
So that's 20 years later, damn near. You know what I mean? That's crazy. That's crazy.
Yeah. So as far as your stuff, you know, you had the Blue Mondays record that was kind of a collection of early stuff there.
Mm-hmm.
And that had definitely some kind of Southern feeling songs on it, like we're talking about.
Clap, clap. Stop that. Girl, look what you done did, better lick that up. Drunk about a second when I tip my cup. Look around, all I see is riders making the band spit hot fire.
That was kind of just I was living back in Detroit. I was staying in my mom's basement. And I never planned on putting that album out.
Right, because it took 3 years from when it was recorded.
Yeah, I didn't really care to put anything out at that time, to be honest. I was just kind of like in a... And I mean, you know, the song spanned a decent amount of time. So there was a period of that, of making that project where, yes, I wanted to, you know, really start popping off. You know, around that time, I just had started really working with and getting to know Denmark.
This is Cole's frequent collaborator, Denmark Vesey, who takes his name from the leader of an 1822 South Carolina slave revolt.
So, you know, we were kind of, I was just kind of like making songs. In my mind, I didn't have an idea of what the project was, of it being a project. We were just making songs. We were discussing starting a group, Crown Nation. And, you know, I would make some songs in my mom's basement. And sometimes, you know, I was blessed to go and record at the Disc with Magnetic, where, you know, a lot of people, you know, recorded a lot of stuff in Detroit.
The Disc was the name of the studio?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, you know, yeah, I was just kind of making songs. I didn't have any rhyme or reason to them. And then I think it just kind of became an album. So I think that's why it has such a variety of, like how you said, it kind of has a little bit of stuff that has a little bit of a southern sound, kind of has a little stuff that sounds a little more polished, kind of has a little stuff that sounds like it was made in the basement. You probably might get a lot of like sirens and things like that's going on right now. You know what I mean? If you were to really filter out the song, so... I was very unpolished at that time.
Yeah. So Shotgun and Sleek Rifle that you did after that, that was like, it was kind of a turning point for you, I think, career-wise, sonically, like everything.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about making that? Like, did you approach that with like different hopes or expectations or anything that would explain why it sounded different than the stuff on Blue Mondays?
Multiple things. I think that was kind of around the time. One, I was kind of, you know, in a way maturing, where I was like, oh man, you got to get your life together. You got a lady that you're with that you love. You have to do something so that you're not working this, you know, any more crap jobs that you don't want to work. And how are you going to do that if you're giving people just whatever type product? So, you know, step it up. You know, John Kim, one time manager, now PR kind of guy, House Shoes introduced me to him. And, you know, we were kind of politicking. I think I've kind of like maybe over fantasized the story in my head to this at this point. But, you know, we were talking and I was like, you know, what can I do to get you to help me like with an album? You know what I mean? And he was like, if you can get me an album within like the next 2 weeks or, you know, some crazy amount of time like that, then I'll help you put out an album. Because, you know, I knew the way that, you know, me and Denmark put out a Slut Bag Edition, or the way, you know, Blue Mondays was just kind of released. And at that time, I was making a lot of the Awesome and Outer Space CDs too. So, like, you know, we would sell those on the street for money, and, you know, me and my girl at the time. And, you know, like, it was like, I don't want to do that. Like, I want to be able to live comfortable. You know what I mean? So, you know, he said, if I can get an album to him within like 3 weeks or something like that, then he'll help me put it out. A few months later, I got an album to him. But, you know, that was the first time where, you know, I didn't do any recording at home. Like none of that, you know, that was the first time when I would actually go to people's studios where they had a nice mic and, you know, nice, you know, sound, you know what I mean, booths and all that type of stuff to record. And you know, I, and that's also hence the title, you know, it was me in a way feeling like I was going from just kind of a rusty spreadshot to like a more, you know, direct, you know, clean rifle shot, you know?
I present to you the best conceit photo with advantage. You rifle in the right hand, staff in the other. Watch my niggas fall out like a baby's tooth. For change under the...
So, yeah, that was the hopes of it. And then, you know, fast forward to now, I'm still broke and still trying to get money making hip hop music. So, but in my mind, I was going to drop that and I was going to be on world tours all year round, every year.
Right. You have Symbolic Basquiat on that record. Mm-hmm. It was a great, great song. And, the hook on it, you say the Basquiat you're seeing is symbolic of the sound.
I be last in the cut. When y'all niggas in the bar, I be in the draws. Cut. Basquiat you seeing is symbolic of the sound. The Basquiat you seeing is symbolic of the sound. The Basquiat you...
And so I just wanted to see what connections you thought between, like, Basquiat's art, how his painting looks.
Right.
And the kind of music you are making or were making at that time.
Well, one... And I always hate having to answer certain questions like this, because it's like, shoot down your question. But one that's a it's that Denmark line.
Ah.
And it's also a line from Mo Money Less Problems off of the same album.
You need to get your chi up, chakras in the crown. The boss got you seeing it's symbolic of the sound.
But it's Denmark's line, and you know, he says that boss got you seeing it's symbolic of the sound. I would say on a surface level, it's because, you know, collectively we're Crown Nation, and you know,
and
that
the crown was his
yeah,
symbol.
Is
yeah.
The is kind of the, you know, the staple Basquiat
right.
symbol. So I think on a surface level, that's generally just what it means, you know.
Yeah.
Not as awesome, but I would say, you know, the kind of more free thought kind of just, you know, approach that Basquiat had the art is definitely very similar to the sonic and creative approach that I take and I think Denmark also takes to creating music, you know, where it doesn't have to be sensible shapes and, you know, it doesn't have to be, you know, perspective when, you know, foot can be super big and then the head can be super small, you know, and I do think that, you know, you could definitely draw similarities between that and, you know, the way that our music is.
Yeah. And, you know, you have the crook, the enemy, and there's a great, great line. You have a great line on there about like zoot suits. And just like this, using this image of chains dangling off a zoot suit.
Yeah.
Can't stop change or leave chains dangling on my side like chains on the side of a zoot suit. It's a new day and I ain't stopping for Fruit Loops. But when I break...
Can you talk a little bit about using like imagery in your writing? That just reminded me, you know, I thought that was such like great and unusual image.
It's kind of like what I was talking about earlier where I like when I'm writing things a lot of times, sometimes it's just very blunt. You know, I'm just saying what I'm saying, but I do think it is good to be able to hear something and see things that, like I said, you know, a lot of times, and people sometimes say that, like, I'll make a song that's super serious to me and people be like, man, that song was funny. And I'm like, man, that was real serious to me, man. But I do think I naturally do that where I'll write something. And I'll try to picture different things, and if it makes me chuckle, a lot of times I go with it. But that, you know, I think that comes through when people hear the music. I use a lot of imagery because I want people to get that same experience when they hear it that I got thinking about it. You know what I mean? And so yeah, little things like, you know, I think when I hear that line, I think about off the Malcolm X movie and Denzel and Spike walking with their zoot suits and the chains hanging and all that. And, you know, so I think it is good to have, good visuals with your raps because it, you know, puts people in places, you know, it puts people where your mind was at or, you know, just lets them travel from place to place while still sitting in that one room, which is the song.
Yeah. And that song actually is about, you know, for all that image is like, kind of funny and interesting. It's a very serious song. It's about being your own worst enemy in
right.
your life.
Exactly, yeah.
The enemy is right behind your eyes, nigga. They ain't holding you back, it's just your mind,
sitting there trying to blame it on everybody else when it's, you know, when it's you. We, a group of really close friends of mine, we lived together for a long time, different groupings and or different pairings at different times, but we would never have any arguments about anything, like if something spilled on something or something got broken, anything like that. The house motto was, don't blame me, blame yourself. Like, so, you know what I mean? So I, you know, it was like, man, where'd that mail go that I had on the table, man? Did someone move it? Maybe. Shouldn't have had it on the table. You know what I mean? There's always something that you do. Mm-hmm. You know, and not everything can apply. It doesn't necessarily apply to everything, but for the most part, there's, you know, action and reaction. So, you know, the enemy and the crook is a really real song to me, because, and I think it should be to everybody, because you have to reach a point where you're not pointing the finger anywhere else, and, you know, you have to solve your own problems. But then at the same time, just because I'm a humorous dude, and then I sprinkle a little bit of humor in it.
Yeah, that's kind of a big theme on that record, because you talk about that also on New Beginning for Infinity, about, mm-hmm. like, I don't blame, you know, my father, I don't blame, you know, for leaving, I don't blame, like, mm-hmm. the system for holding me back or whatever, like, right. I get around things and over things.
Cause I never blame my pops for ditching or the system for building fences. I jump them bitches, I knock them down, I smack.
Those seem like pretty major things to kind of not be resentful of.
Yeah, I'm a hardcore internalist. Like, hardcore. So I don't really look to outward things. Mm-hmm. I do definitely take the full weight of pretty much everything, which probably isn't the most healthy thing. I'm sure one of these days I'm just going to explode and shoot at everybody or something.
So the next two records after that, mm-hmm. you recorded in one order, but released, ended up for whatever series of probably very complicated reasons, ended up getting released in a different order. How was that for you? Do you think that affected the reception of the albums or what people got out of them or anything like that?
No, because I really kind of feel like they came out when they needed to. I always feel like when you have like a personal good feeling about things, even if it's the same product, people can feel that somehow, like as if it's some aura that's floating around the project. And so, you know, when Niggas Is Men came out, it was like a very therapeutic process making that project, you know. And so when it finally came out to people's ears so that they could hear it, I felt like it still had that glow from me on it. And the same with Ghost at the Finish Line, you know, the irony of that album and the title, and then where I was in my life as it was being wrapped up and ready to be put out. You know what I mean? It was like, you know, I guess it wasn't supposed to come out then. It was supposed to come out now, because, you know, it's fitting to my life. So, you know, maybe hopefully that release date, you know, would make it fit in maybe to someone else's life, as, you know, the stars and so on and so forth work. When you know, you're going through something, there's a good chance there's, you know, a lot of other people going through the same thing. So, yeah. You know, I try to have like I feel like everything happened when it was supposed to happen kind of thing, yeah. You know.
And so what exactly does it mean to Al Bundy, that hoe?
I Al Bundy, that hoe. I Doug Funny, that hoe. Pimp C and Bumby, that hoe. Cameron and Dougie, that hoe. I don't get nam money to that hoe. Get nam money to that hoe.
Oh, man.
I just thought that was a great sort of funny thing to put in a hook. Like,
it's a silly, that whole hook is ridiculous. And I thought it was so hilarious when I came up with it. I just laughed all the way home and straight. I laughed all the way home through the door, all the way to the mic. I was laughing. And yes, to Al Bundy, that hoe, watch any episode of Married with Children. watch any episode where either he has to deal with Peggy or he's at work, and you know, how look at how he reacts to basically any woman on that show.
Come, Penelope, let's go someplace where they treat us with respect.
Try the moon, you're way less there.
And that would be Al Bundy in that, huh? You know.
Yeah. So goes to the finish line, right? The very first words, there's an intro, but the very first words you say on it are waking up in the same place every fucking day. No fucking way.
Stressed out, trying to figure out the best route and the chest out so no one knows that I'm stressed out.
Why open the album with that?
That's how I felt, man. It's crazy. It's crazy because, you know, when in the music industry, you know, I can't say this is for everybody, but there's such extreme highs and lows, you know? So when I made that song, like, you know, a little while after I made it, I was still making the rest of the songs for the album. I remember I sat on my back porch and I was kind of just listening back through what I got. And I listened to that song and I burst into tears, like, I mean, hardcore, like, uncontrollable, grown-ass man, you know, Cam'ron and Killer Season, snotty tears, you know what I mean? And then about, I would say within, you know, it's somewhere within the last, like, couple months, I was preparing for a show and I was going to do that song in the show. So, you know, I kind of put together a kind of different version because I don't really like the way that beat sounds on stage. So I make like a new, you know, live kind of version of it. And I'm rapping the song and I burst into tears like crazy because I'm like, fuck, I'm in the same situation again. So, you know what I mean? I felt like that was just the realest thing I could say. That's how I felt. And it's... oddly enough, I'm right back there again. You know what I mean? You know, trying to convince my lady that I'm going to be big shit. That then, now, you know, trying to accrue the wealth that I promised myself. The fans treat me like I made it. I ain't made shit. That's more real now than it was then. Because now there's more people listening to my music and more people hitting me up and asking me to do shit and all this shit. And it's like, I can't do nothing. You know what I mean? Just because I got a blue check next to my name on Twitter, I can't do shit, man. You know what I'm saying? So, you know, so it's one of those weird songs where it ironically comes back to me sometimes realer than ever. But that happens with a lot of my music.
I was going to say, you've said that like there'll be in your songs things you put there as kind of messages to yourself.
Yeah.
And so stuff kind of will hit you later.
Mm-hmm. Sometimes, a lot of times in my songs, you know, some of the funniest, wittiest lines where it sounds like I'm taking a jab at, you know, so-and-so whack person, I'm talking to myself. Sometimes I'm taking a jab at myself, but it just sounds better when you go like, you know, this, you know, monkey head, you know, motherfucker, something silly like that.
Yeah.
And can't do this because you can't do that, you know, some shit like that. And sometimes I'm actually talking about myself, you know. But it's a weird, you know, it's that weird process of, like, you know, just when it's not really contrived music and you're not like, you know, I'm making an album about this. If it's just a process where you're just letting it spill out, that's bound to happen, you know. If you're honest.
Yeah. And, you know, you've Innocent Country, I think your most recent full length.
Mm-hmm.
Something I picked up on Drugfest 2002.
Yeah.
Kind of a little shout out to Gutfest 89, old digital underground song.
We just would like to say welcome to Gutfest 89.
Crazy guts. It's Gutfest 89.
Yo, Drugfest 2002. What type of drugs y'all trying to do? Come on, yo, y'all fucking with them shrooms?
Hell yeah. And it seems like maybe, you know, given what I've heard of your music, Sex Packet's probably an album you listen to once or twice.
Yes, but that's weird. I didn't even think about that.
Oh, really?
Yeah, nah, I didn't even think about that. I just, Chris had the beat and he hated it. And I thought it was so stupid and silly. And that was just the first thing that came to my mind when I heard it, you know. And we were, you know, we were admittedly probably intoxicated and high in different ways at the moment. So it just felt right, you know what I mean? But I did not draw that connection. Yeah, that's pretty ill. Damn, dude. So that's cool. No, that's
wow.
dope. Yeah,
all right.
I'll take that as a compliment.
Yeah. Definitely. And, you know, if we wanted a live on that record, where you, pretty kind of serious mm-hmm. part in the middle where you encourage people to learn to get love by giving love.
Mm-hmm. Learn to get love by giving love. Let that stick to your body like fish fries.
I guess I just wanted to delve into that for a second. Like, is that something you had to learn for yourself before you could say it on a record? Did saying it on a record help you to internalize it more?
Yeah. Learn to get love. Learn to get love. I think it's something that I had to learn a lot earlier in life.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was like a reverse learning process. Kind of learning that, you know, being mistreated by people, all that types of shit, that just happens in life. You know what I mean? And being like, man, that shit that nigga did makes me hate that person. So, you know, naturally, if I don't want people to hate me, then you learn that, you know what I mean? So I think it's just been something that I've learned over time. And also, you know, I've lived in so many different places and had such a wide variety of friends and, you know, people that I consider brothers and sisters, you know? So, when you move around a lot as a kid, or, you know, and your adult life, if you move around a lot, you have to, you have to learn to meet people, to make friends, to, you know, start over. So, I mean, it's just been like a trial by fire type lesson that you learn, you know what I mean? But I think you learn it both ways. You learn it from what you do, but I think mostly I learned that from what things that have been done to me.
Yeah. And, you know, Nothing Moves, you did a video for. Mm-hmm. And I want to talk, you know, about your videos generally in a second, but, you know, the video is kind of a tribute to Rap Hands. So. Yeah.
One, I love Rap Hands.
I was saying, who has the best rap hands in the game right now?
You know what? Kaz got some really good rap hands. I think those are my favorite rap hands right now. Have you've seen any? Of course, you've seen Kaz videos, right?
I don't think so.
No? Oh, man. Go watch some Kaz videos, man. Like, if it's not one where he's just kind of, you know, doing the more some, and he's just kind of like sitting there thinking, it's not as much movement. But the ones where he's moving, he'd be getting his hands in there. I really appreciated that. I can't remember the specific video, but, you know, I was about to say the black and white one, but I think pretty much all his videos are black and white. But Ka right now has some really good rap hands. Who else? Because I don't like the new style rap hands. Like, I don't like the Drake rap hands. You know what I mean? I don't like that kind of more dancey rap hands. I like... You know, I mean, I think like one of the last rap hand greats was maybe Jay, because he had like that kind of Tyrannosaurus Rex hand, you know what I mean, rap hand,
yeah.
Where he just basically was resting his wrist on his chest and just kind of moving his fingers a little bit. Yeah, he has some pretty good rap hands, but no, I think Ka's my favorite right
yeah.
now.
Yeah, he's... I don't know if I've seen videos, although I love him, and Ka, if you're listening, welcome on the show anytime. But yeah, your videos generally are pretty great and pretty all over the place, like a very sort of unique and crazy concepts.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there was the one you did where you were kind of all in neon. There was the Where the yeah. Wild Things Roam
mm-hmm.
video. And you direct a lot of those, right?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
So how is directing videos? Is that like, how is that different than making a song? Like, what kind of different stuff are you thinking about?
I'm a big kid in the way that I really like arts and crafts. Like, you know, I know that's a real hard thing to say, but a nigga likes arts and crafts, like, a lot. So I enjoy making stuff, you know, and I think a lot of my videos definitely, you could tell that, you know what I mean, from, you know, the chin puppet thing, which was actually Fresh's idea. I was talking to him, I was like, I need to come up with a video idea. And he was like, do chin puppets. And then I think he said it like jokingly, and I was like, yeah, that's what we're going to do. You know what I mean?
It was amazing. It was great to see you and him and Vaughn and Will upside down. Were you laying on the floor? Like, how did you do that?
Yeah, we just, laid out green screen on the floor and then laid out a second layer on top and dressed up the chins and just kind of went from there. But, you know, that and always was a big fan of the Muppet Show when I was young. So, you know, like the Ghost at the Finish Line video, it's kind of a tribute to, you know, a couple different sketches that have happened on the Muppet Show and on Sesame Street, kind of like that, you know, black light kind of dancing puppets over in front of a black screen type of deal. But just in this case, I was the puppet, which is, you know, if you want to get real deep, which is kind of what the song's about, you know. And then, a lot of my videos tend to be kind of the ones that aren't just kind of more rappy, you know. There's like Another Blunt, and there's like the Symbolic video, Live Alone, Die Alone. There's like kind of videos like that. But for the most part, a lot of my videos, now that I'm talking about it with you, are very much so things pulled from being a kid. You know what I mean? Which is kind of weird. It gives me a chance to kind of get those things out of my system that I've never been able to do visually and that I always enjoyed seeing myself. Where the Wild Things Roam, you know, obviously, you know, it's kind of like, a bunch of, you know, Max, you know, Max would put on his little animal costume and trounce around the house and threaten to eat his mom's neck and stuff like that. And, you know, so, I mean, it's my chance to get away with getting to do those things. And at the same time, have people go like, yo, that's cool. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And I saw literally just yesterday a new single. An upcoming instrumental album.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, as someone who like is very invested in the song making process of bringing together lyrics and beats, why an instrumental record?
Oh, I could give you the political reason, but I'm going to give you the interesting reason. And it's something I actually did start a while ago, and it was the instrumental album is called Lullabies for the Broken Brain. And I started a beat CD a while ago called just A Broken Brain. And, discussing, trying to figure out, you know, because I have another full-length vocal album coming out called Being You Is Great. I Wish I Could Be You More Often. And, you know, the process of making an album for me a lot of times, as, you know, we've already discussed, is a little lengthy. From time to time, because I, you know, approach things in weird ways. So I really, you know, I wanted to still be able to focus on my album, but also be able to give people something, you know what I mean, on the fan level, but then also just on the level of, you know, people, especially nowadays, want to keep hearing new things, you know what I mean? So it seemed like the most fitting way for me to be able to give people something without, you know, rushing the album that I'm trying to make and without taking away from things that I need, pieces that I still need to make that album. You know what I mean? So, and I mean, it's not just like an instrumental album where it's just a beat and a beat and a beat and a beat. It all flows together. You know what I mean? If I had my druthers, it would just be on a tape. Or on a vinyl, just has one track each side. You know what I'm saying? So, it's not really something where you could kind of skip around from beat to beat. It's something that you is meant to listen to in its entirety. So it's not a cop out beat tape. You know, it's really something. But at the same time, like I said, I really needed to, you know, I need more time for this album, this next vocal album. So, and, you know, I want to give the people something so they're not waiting until, you know, December for another Quelle project.
Yeah. What else is going on? You got the instrumental record coming out, working on the the vocal album. Anything else to tell the people?
The album that I think I started mentioning it in interviews like 3 years ago at this point. So that there you go. That's how that works again. But it's called Being You Is Great. I Wish I Could Be You More Often. And that's the album I'm currently working on. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's just like with everything, it's just got to be right. Once I feel like I got enough jewels in the bag, though, then, and, you know, I lay them all out on the table and I think they all look nice together, then that will definitely be coming out. And it's going to be, it's ice cold so far, but I just keep putting new strokes from the paintbrush on it.
You know? All right. Well, thanks. We look forward to hearing it. Thanks for coming through, Quelle.
Oh, thank you.
This isn't the first time I've met Quelle, Chris. You know, I've seen him out a lot. We've hung out. I've even seen him do a mean karaoke version of Bowie's Life on Mars. But I'd never sat down with him one-on-one to talk about his music. I'm really glad I did. One of the things I really love about his music is his commitment to being original. And there's this one thing he says kind of offhandedly during the interview that really brings that out. He mentioned that he would rework a lyric if he caught himself repeating a pattern that he used like 5 or 6 albums ago. That kind of commitment to not repeating yourself, even though no one would ever notice, is admirable and really all too rare. I also love that he puts so much stock in what he finds original and amusing. All the times when he said, oh, well, you know, the things that make me chuckle, the things that I find unusual, that's what goes into my songs. And that really, really shows through. In all his music, whatever crazy twists and turns it takes, there's hardly ever a boring moment, and I think that's true of our conversation as well. Join us next week when we have the return of Saul Williams. He'll be here to talk about his brand new album, Martyr, Loser, King. Our two previous episodes with Saul are some of my favorite that we've ever done. In addition to putting out a bunch of spectacular albums, Saul's released tons of books of poetry, performed as a spoken word artist, starred in movies, and he also had the lead role in the Tupac-inspired Broadway musical Holler If You Hear Me, which we talk about in depth on episode 71. As I mentioned at the top of the show, make sure you subscribe to The Cipher on your podcast app of choice. If that app happens to be iTunes, give us a rating or a review. If you want to take an extra step to support the show, make a donation at patreon.com/thecipher show. Even a couple bucks a month will go a long way. You can find us everywhere on social media at The Cipher Show. Hit us up. Let us know what you thought of this episode, ideas for future guests, anything you'd want to talk about. More information about this or any other episode, including playlists and a lot more, can be found at thecyphershow.com. While you're there, make sure to sign up for our mailing list so you can keep track of everything that's going on. The Cipher is created and written by Sean Sotero.
I fucking hate ciphers so much, man.
The show is produced and engineered by Josh Cross at Crosstown Studios.
Boy, that's so silly. That's so stupid. Let's do that.
Our music is by 42 Ghosts.
Black light, kind of dancing puppets over in front of a black screen type of deal.
Our web guru is Aaron Young.
I really don't care.
Our intern is Aziza Hassan.
House Shoes introduced me.
Special thanks to Patreon supporter Scott Limbacher.
The weird old guy with like, you know, 6 arms and his brain is super big and stuff.
We'll see you next time around on The Cipher.
Like fish dicks.